Madcast, Saturday, May 16th, 2015. Hey, Mac Geeks, it's time for your Madcast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the Maccast. Well, you ever have one of those periods in life where you wish your life was a little bit like a computer and you could just do a reboot? Yeah, that's what I'm doing this week. I'm doing a little reboot on what's been happening technology-wise in my life. If you've been following me on Twitter, you probably know I've had all kinds of issues. Actually, if you've seen me on a couple of the video podcasts I do, specifically when I was on Mac Break Weekly and also weekly when I do the Mac Show over on the British Tech Network, I've been having all kinds of Skype video connectivity issues. And it all came to a head this week where I literally couldn't even do a recording for the iOS show. And turns out that there is something definitely wrong with my internet connection that's totally outside of my control. So it's completely, I got completely frustrated with technology this week. And on top of that, I ended up having some Mac and other kinds of issues to the point where I'm pretty sure it's time for me to do what we call a nuke and pave of my operating system, which I don't relish doing. If you've ever done that before, and for those of you who don't know what I'm talking about, I mean basically needing to go to my backups, basically erase my internal hard drive, restore from backup, just the minimal stuff like documents, don't even bring over any applications, basically clean out my entire system because I've just got too many weird, quirky things going on. So maybe we can turn that into a positive, though, and make that sort of some Maccast content. I'm going to talk a little bit about some troubleshooting today. So I'm actually taking some of the stuff that happened to me this week and turning it into content, which I guess that's my first step in sort of rebooting the week in technology. But really, I'm rebooting my attitude because I was pretty bummed out this week. I don't know how you get when technology fails you, but I get extremely agitated and frustrated. Oh, here's another bonus. I learned that if you get really angry, you actually get exercise credit on your Apple Watch. I think because your heart rate goes up so much, it thinks you're working out. So I did get some credit there on my Apple Watch. But regardless, I've got a great Maccast for you today. Lots of cool stuff to talk about. We're going to talk about Apple expanding its environmental efforts in China. More stuff on iPad Pro rumors. Watch deliveries, Apple Watch deliveries, why they're slow and why things might be getting better. Also, the redesigned music app and music services for the iPhone, or for iOS 8.4, rather, and rumors of the next generation phone, and something I'm excited about, HomeKit. Are we finally going to get that? We'll talk about that a little bit in this episode. Also, I've got some feedback on running Time Machine on external drives. I made a little bit of an error there I need to correct on the last episode. Also, we're going to talk about troubleshooting Mac issues, something I'm intimately familiar with this week. And also, we've got a review. Oliver sent us a great review of an Apple Watch stand. Also, some comments from Jeff on Apple Watch, just his thoughts and opinions there. And we're going to talk about I turned on iCloud Photo Library this week. I'll share my experience with you. I'm chuckling a little bit, which may mean that you can guess how I'm going to feel about it. Let's just say, again, remember, technology for me this week didn't go all that well? Yeah, that's a little precursor of what we're going to be talking about. And then some more questions about photos, since we talked about that on the last episode. And of course, my thing of the moment. So tons of stuff to get into. We might as well just jump right in. But before we do that, I do want to welcome a new sponsor to the Maccast, and that is Warby Parker. Warby Parker is a company. They were founded with a rebellious spirit and a lofty objective. They wanted to create boutique quality, classically crafted eyewear at a revolutionary price point. Basically, they make the process of buying glasses easy and risk-free. They do it online, which you may think is a little bit unusual, but they have a great program. They have a home try-on program that lets you order up to 5 pairs of glasses to be shipped directly to your door. You get to try them on in the comfort of your own home. You can get feedback from friends and family, your colleagues. A lot of people seem to go online, go to Twitter, ask people's opinion about their Warby Parker frames, and you get to keep the frames for 5 days. So you can check them out. You can, you know, put them on, set them aside, come back to them, and all of the shipping to you and back to them is totally free, and there's absolutely no obligation to purchase. But if you go check out warbyparker.com, you'll see they have a large selection, but not overwhelming selection, of vintage-inspired designs with a contemporary twist. Really nice-looking frames. And like I said, you know, if you've ever bought glasses before and you go into a glasses store, you're just, it's like almost too much, right? So they really pare down just to classic styles that you'll really like. And the great thing is that they believe glasses shouldn't cost as much as your iPhone. So pricing starts at just $95, and that includes prescription lenses. Not just prescription lenses, though, but all of their glasses include anti-reflective and anti-glare coating at no additional cost. That's something you usually get upcharged quite a bit for. Also, their glasses include a hard case and cleaning cloth, so you really get everything you need shipped right to you. And their lower prices are also great if you just want to maybe get glasses to accessorize your wardrobe. Maybe you just need non-prescription glasses. Maybe you want sunglasses. They have non-prescription polarized sunglasses starting at just $95 also. And if you need prescription sunglasses, well, they handle those too, starting at just $150. And a really cool thing that they do is they also believe in giving back. So for every pair of glasses that they sell, they also distribute glasses to someone in need through nonprofits like Vision Spring. So they're giving back to the community. And the great news is that if you go to warbyparker.com/MacCast to get your 5 try-on frames now, then just by visiting that URL, when you come back and you place your order, you're going to get free 3-day shipping. So you get expedited shipping on your final frame choice. So I want you to check them out, warbyparker.com/MacCast to get your try-ons. And so happy to have Warby Parker on as a new sponsor of the MacCast. We thank them for that, and you should check them out. So as I said, Apple has been expanding their environmental efforts. It's been a good year for Apple on their environmental initiatives. And this week they announced a new multi-year project with the World Wildlife Fund to actually significantly increase their responsibly managed forest program, specifically in China. What's happening is Apple wants to protect as many as 1 million acres of working forests in the region to provide fiber pulp and wood products, virgin wood products, for their packaging. And the project is going to include the planting of new trees, implementing new environmental standards, and also working to produce less pollution in paper manufacturing in China. It has the same kinds of goals, but is a bit different than their recently announced program in Maine and North Carolina. If you may remember, Apple there actually went and purchased about 36,000 acres of private forest land that they're actually going to manage and protect. In China, what they're doing is they're working with the World Wildlife Fund. The World Wildlife Fund is actually going to go in. They're going to work with local farm owners to help them develop sustainable methods for managing their land. And then Apple is going to be covering the costs of the program. So Apple continuing to expand their environmental initiatives. Also, along with this announcement, they provided a bit more detail on their plans for a 40-megawatt solar power project in China. It's actually going to be 2 different 20-megawatt solar installations. Apple said the solar farm is going to be designed to minimize the ecological impact that they have, and also will be set up to protect grasslands necessary for yak populations in China. So we'll have the added benefit of protecting some wildlife there. It's expected to generate enough energy to power the equivalent of 61,000 Chinese homes, and that energy output would be used to offset the energy used by Apple's corporate offices and retail stores. Currently, right now, about 87% of Apple's operations around the world run on renewable energy. They actually got some awards recently from Greenpeace for these efforts. They're hoping to get to a goal of 100%. So this new solar installation should help, again, continue to further them along the way toward that goal. And another interesting thing about this announcement is Tim Cook used the timing to also fire up his official Weibo account, which is basically in China, from what I understand, the equivalent of Twitter. And that's where he posted the information about this initiative. And he picked up 261,000 plus followers on the very first day of setting up his new account. I didn't look to see how many he has now. I would imagine he's going to get to a million very quickly if he's not already there. He probably is at this point. And then also just on the operations front, Apple may be expanding its manufacturing in Ireland. Actually, again, Apple currently has a factory in Cork, Ireland. It's centered mostly on Mac production. And in fact, Apple, as you may remember, uses its presence in Ireland to actually help funnel some of its international revenues and take advantage of favorable tax laws there. Apple isn't the only company that does this, and it's perfectly legal. But the European Commission has been looking into making changes pretty soon so that companies will likely have to pay higher taxes in the region. But even though those changes are coming, it hasn't stopped Apple from actually expanding there, and they're considering expanding more. Apparently, Apple spent about 3 million euros, about $334.3 million on an expansion just about a year and a half ago. And they also have leases on two downtown Cork office blocks. And now, according to independent.ie, Apple may want to build into the Cork County Council land bank, which would almost double their factory space there. The report doesn't note what Apple is considering doing. And it also mentions that they are also considering possibly a smaller expansion. So it looks like there's kind of two initiatives on the book. But basically, it's thought that the additional factory space would likely be used to increase their Mac production there. But I guess they could be also getting to set up using this space to set up for something else. It's really unclear at this point. But again, Apple may be expanding their manufacturing presence in Ireland. Maybe one of the things they're going to be building over there is the new iPad Pro. Those rumors don't seem to be subsiding at all. How long have we been talking about the iPad Pro? Seems like years at this point. This week, Korea IT News reported that Apple has requested silver nanowire material samples from LG Display, Samsung Display, Japan Display, and other display manufacturers. According to the report, the silver nanowire technology panels are more flexible than some of the current touch technologies that Apple uses. It's created from a mesh of silver wires, approximately 1 nanometer in diameter, and the material is incredibly thin and clear, and also supposedly has conductive properties that are better than some of the current technologies, which means the displays may not need additional sensors to actually determine touch locations. So, because of that, it's believed that these properties might make a better technology for force touch, especially in larger display devices like the rumored 12.9-inch iPad Pro. In addition, the silver nanowire is also apparently cheaper to manufacture because it doesn't use some of the rare materials like indium during the production process. That could mean the panels are a little bit cheaper, but Cult of Mac points out that Apple also plans to use a higher-end and sturdier sapphire glass in the iPad Pro, so a lot of the cost savings with the nanowire technology could actually just be wiped out. It's also believed that the iPad Pro display might offer multiple levels of pressure sensitivity that would appeal to digital artists who want to work directly on the device, though it's also been said that that pressure sensitivity may come via a new Apple Bluetooth stylus, which has been rumored around the new iPad model. Just to finish things up on the iPad Pro rumors, some of the other features that have been rumored include NFC technology that would not be for actually making Apple payments or Apple Pay payments, but rather for being able to use the iPad Pro as an Apple Pay terminal. And USB-C port that might replace the Lightning connector. I think that's very likely to happen and might happen also on the rumored new iPhone that we'll be talking about here in a minute. And then also there's still the rumors that it will have a stereo four-speaker design. So two speakers on each side to give you better sound. I'm assuming that's something that would appeal to people who want to use the iPad Pro for music and DJing and those sorts of things. So I don't know how I feel about an iPad Pro. We had some leaked sort of size comparisons. I guess not really leaked, but somebody did some mock-up size comparisons of what a 12.9-inch iPad would look like. The thing is huge. Is this something that there's even a market for now that we have the 12-inch MacBook, you know, Retina MacBook, and we've got MacBook Airs? It seems to me like once you get into that form factor, you might want to just jump up to a notebook. But I don't know. Maybe this is a target market that I'm just not getting at this point. I'd be curious to know your thoughts. I already know from a number of your emails that there are quite a few of you who ordered your Apple Watch early or even on day one and still don't have your delivery, although it does seem like Apple is starting to get more watch orders out. We're actually well over a month past the pre-order date, and folks that placed orders within minutes after the watch went on sale still don't have their pre-orders, which is just baffling. But just this week, we finally got some good news. Some of the stainless steel case with link bracelet models started actually arriving in the hands of customers. I know a few of you received yours, and it seems like there's more on the way. According to Apple's manufacturing partner, Quanta, at least some of the delays occurred, they say, because of a worker shortage. The company was basically coming forward to clear the air because we had been hearing reports, and I guess they had been hearing them too, that poor yield rates were causing the Apple Watch to trickle out slowly. Now, they didn't specifically mention Apple or the watch when they made their statements, but they said they were responding to reports of low yield rates of a smartwatch, and they referenced a smartwatch that was, quote, unlike the smartwatches it has ever produced before. The company's vice chairman stated that there weren't enough workers available during the Lunar New Year holidays. That was back in February, but now that is no longer an issue. At the time, they said they had to borrow staff from other manufacturers to keep production running, and as a result, they could only deliver limited quantities to their customer. Again, they didn't name their customer, but I think we can guess who it was. So hopefully, if things get better quickly, Apple may be able to start getting more watches into the hands of more customers, and hopefully we'll start to see some in-store inventory soon. It's kind of a shame still that you can't walk into an Apple store and actually buy an Apple Watch. And we did see some of the July estimated delivery dates start being bumped up to maybe June. I know things have been going the other way as well. Some of you reported that you had a June delivery date and you received notice that you're actually going to be getting it very late in June, and we're hoping maybe to get a little bit sooner. So regardless, at least according to Quanta, it wasn't any kind of low yield or production issues. It was more just sort of a staffing thing related to the Lunar New Year holidays. Some more information on the Apple Watch that came out this week. It may be a little bit more waterproof than Apple is letting on. Blogger Ray Maker took the Apple Watch for a swim, and it did perfectly fine. The fitness app, of course, can't track swimming, but Maker did do an intense 20-minute workout, a 1,000-meter swim in the pool, and the watch came out with flying colors. They also then took the watch on a couple of high dives, twice off a 5-meter platform and once again off a 10-meter platform, and again, no issues whatsoever. Now, the Apple Watch, as we've talked about, does have an IPX7 waterproof rating, and that means basically that it can survive 30 minutes into up to 3 meters of water, so it's not surprising that it actually passed the swimming test. But what is surprising is that Maker then put the watch through a more rigorous test in a dunk tank, basically a water chamber that simulated the watch being submerged in depths up to about 40 meters. It went through various levels for about 8 minutes of waterproof testing, and again, it survived. And that's definitely well beyond the IPX7 rating that Apple says the watch has. Now, I'm giving you this information purely as information. Apple says the watch is absolutely not waterproof. You are not supposed to go swimming with it. They don't even really advise showering with it, although that is something Tim Cook admitted to doing. So if you do end up swimming or diving with your watch, you are absolutely on your own, especially if Apple can figure out that that's what you did. They're not going to cover that under your AppleCare or AppleCare Plus warranty. Another big hubbub that popped up this week over the Apple Watch was the fact that while the Apple Watch does have a passcode lock on it, that passcode lock, unlike your iPhone, is not an activation lock. I don't think anybody was really confused about that, but just in case, iDownload blog noted that while your passcode will protect your watch from, you know, data theft, it's not actually going to protect it from a thief actually being able to use your watch after they steal it. Can protect your Apple Pay, but it doesn't prevent resetting or repairing the Apple Watch. Basically, if you take the Apple Watch off, even with the passcode lock, if you go to the power down screen by holding the side button down for a couple seconds and then force touch on that screen, what you'll see is an option to erase all contents and settings from the watch that basically factory resets the watch without having to put a passcode, without having to put the passcode in or anything else. And then after that, it can actually be paired up with a new iPhone and set up as a new Apple Watch. Of course, the media took this news information and completely blew it way out of proportion once again. Apple never made any promises of anti-theft protection or activation locking the phone. Could they or should they be doing more to protect the watch? Maybe, maybe not. I think that's likely up to debate, and we can maybe go back and forth on that. But I really don't think this is any huge revelation or anything that most people need to worry about. You know, no other smartwatch on the market has an activation lock either. And we didn't even get that feature on our phones for a while. So maybe it's something that'll come down the pipeline. A lot of people have already been throwing out some pretty creative ideas where Apple could do a little bit better for theft protection. I'm sure Apple's listening. I'm sure they've thought of some of these things already. And maybe in a future update, they will implement something. But for now, just know that you do not have theft protection on your Apple Watch. And another Apple product that has been in short supply and taking a little bit of time to get to customers is the gorgeous new MacBooks. Apple has been slowly trickling those out to pre-order customers. And unfortunately, it looks like some of those folks, specifically in Europe, are getting an unwelcome surprise in the form of a pre-dented MacBook. It looks like it already has some wear and tear on it. The issue seems to be possibly the new redesigned European power supply and the packaging. So what's happening is the power supply is popping up during shipping and handling and then pressing into the bottom case, causing two sort of little crease-like dents. The trouble now being that if you do receive a unit like that, getting a replacement could be pretty tricky. Because again, Apple is just barely getting those out to consumers at this point. And as far as replacement parts, I would imagine they are few and far between. So it's unclear at this point if this is a widespread problem or something more isolated. I'm hoping it's on the isolated side. But if you have received a new MacBook and noticed this problem, be sure to let us know about it. I'm kind of curious to see if it really is widespread. And as far as getting a replacement, that might get a little bit better because we're also getting reports that retail employees were being told that limited quantities of the MacBook should start arriving and be available in select Apple stores in the US, UK, Canada, Australia, the Netherlands, Switzerland, Germany, France, Italy, China, Hong Kong, Spain, and Sweden. Huh, that's a number of retail stores around the week of May 25th. So in a little while, you should be able to maybe go into an Apple store finally and buy a new MacBook. They do have display units there that you can check out, but just like the Apple Watch, consumers were being told that they had to order online and have them either directly shipped to the store or shipped to their homes. So supplies may be picking up on the new MacBooks as well. Mac Rumors also noted that there has been a slowing in the shipping times for the high-end 15-inch Retina MacBook Pro. And anytime that happens, that could mean a sign that a refresh is coming. That's caused some in the Mac community to think that Apple might be planning on doing a little rev of the 15-inch Retina MacBook Pro sometime around WWDC. Part of what is fueling that speculation is some new Broadwell chips that are supposed to arrive this summer, but the timing is a little bit off. I think Intel has said the new Broadwell chips that would be appropriate for an updated MacBook Pro would not be arriving until July or August. So a June announcement might be a little bit too soon, unless they're planning on announcing in June and then shipping sometime in July. Apple has also sometimes been able to get from Intel kind of first dibs on some of the new chips. So maybe they've worked out a deal just because of the sheer volume that they're going to put together. And maybe we will see an updated MacBook Pro at WWDC, or at least sometime this summer. So if you're thinking about one of those new models, you may want to hold off on your purchase, see what happens around June. And even if we don't hear something in June, you might wait until July, August timeframe to see if Apple does a rev. Something we know Apple is hard at work at putting a revision on is iOS. The next point release, iOS 8.4, is out. Actually, 8.4 Beta 3 was sent out to developers, and it looks like it contains a wholly new redesigned music app. And some of the features are that it will now show pictures of artists in the artist view. It also has a new mini player with a completely redesigned look for the now playing screen, has the ability to have personalized playlists. There is now global search. That's going to be a nice new addition in the music app, and also a new streamlined design for iTunes Radio. Along with this, the update has further fueled rumors that Apple plans to announce a new music service at WWDC in June. We've been talking about that a little bit here on the MacCast. The streaming service will supposedly be integrated into the new music app alongside iTunes Match and the redesigned iTunes Radio service. I had kind of hoped, and I don't know how you felt about this, but I had kind of hoped that Apple might actually split up the music app so that iTunes Radio and the new streaming music service and then My Purchase Music would be in three separate apps, but it's looking like it's going to all fall under one umbrella. Hopefully Apple can pull that off, and hopefully this redesign will help them do it. Not only that, but in addition to sort of having three masters, the new music app will reportedly also bring back Apple's social music service, Ping. Well, not exactly Ping, but something like it, this time only for the artists, according to the reports. The streaming service portion of the music app is reportedly going to be called Apple Music, and it's supposed to have deeper social networking integration for artists. And in essence, artists are going to get to create their own pages, kind of profiles within the service, where they can then post sample tracks to give away, photos, videos, information on updated or on concerts and concert updates, basically different ways that they can directly connect with their fans through the Apple Music service. Now, this sounds to me very similar to what Apple already has in terms of artist pages on iTunes, on the iTunes store. I don't think many people actually check those out, but they do have the ability. They don't have the ability to kind of do blog posting or sort of social media posting, but they do have the features like concert dates and videos and photos. I'm not sure. I don't think they have the ability to put sample tracks up there, but this sounds more like kind of an expansion of that within the Apple Music service. It's also supposedly going to allow artists to share content from other artists, kind of do a cross-post, cross-promotion sort of thing. And users of the service will be able to like and comment on posts using their iTunes account. So you're not going to actually have your own sort of music profile or social music profile within the Apple Music app like you did with Ping. It's more going to be tied to your iTunes account. You'll be able to comment and sort of interact with your favorite artists. Now, one of the reasons people think this service is coming is that in iOS 8.4 Beta 3, in the restrictions area, the parental controls, there was an artist activity toggle, so you could essentially turn this feature off if you didn't want your kids interacting with music artists, I guess. So that was kind of a tip-off of the new feature. That, along with some other sort of insider reports that had been leaking out. Apple also plans to make the Apple Music service work across platforms, it looks like. iOS, Android, and Mac versions are reportedly planned. So just like Beats Music, they're going to be able to extend the service over into the Android platform. And if you are a current subscriber to Beats, they are going to make the transition over to Apple's new music service easy, according to reports. A lot of the playlists, curation, and organizational features of Beats Music is supposedly going to be retained, and users are going to be able to port over their existing Beat Music cloud libraries into the new Apple Music service. So, I don't know. Apple's been getting a lot of buzz about their streaming music service. I'm curious to see how it's going to be different or better than some of the offerings that are already out there. We've already seen companies like Spotify sort of, you know, getting ready and adding new features, coming down on pricing, making new offers to try and sort of solidify themselves or protect themselves against Apple's new music service. So they're already kind of creating waves, and it'll be interesting to see how well received this is. Again, Apple hasn't had a huge great track record in this area with online services, social media, those sorts of things. Is this going to finally be the thing that shows Apple can pull it off? I'm hoping with the talent that they brought in from Beats, it will. I tried out the Beats Music service for a little bit. I was pretty impressed, although it didn't have sticking power for me. So I'm curious what you think. Is this something that you're excited about? Maybe you have reservations like I do. Give us a little feedback, maccast@gmail.com. This week, we got some pretty specific rumors from a pretty trusted source about the next generation iPhone, the iPhone 6S and 6S Plus. This information coming from KGI securities analyst Ming-Chi Kuo. He actually had 11 next-gen iPhone rumors to share with his investors. He's saying that we can expect new 4.7-inch and 5.5-inch iPhones and that they will enter mass production sometime in mid to late August. So your typical fall release time frame for an updated iPhone. Interestingly, unlike some rumors have predicted, he says no 4-inch model this year, not ruling out the possibility that it might happen sometime next year. The addition of Force Touch technology to both devices, the iPhone 6S and the 6S Plus. Like we've heard in the past, it's expected that there will be a new Apple A9 processor and that that will come with doubled 2 gigabytes of RAM. You photographers out there will be happy because for the first time in a long time, we're hearing a rumor that Apple will update the EyeSight camera. They're going to move from the 8-megapixel model they have now up to 12 megapixels, according to Ming-Chi Kuo. The new phone design will have an added mic to help improve voice quality and a new rose gold color option. Notice I said color option, not real rose gold. We're going to have no, you know, $50,000 iPhones here, but that gold color will be matched to go along very nicely with your rose gold Apple Watch, if you're lucky enough to have one of those. Additional case design changes could be the addition of some structural modifications to avoid the continuation of bend gate, so no more bendy iPhone 6 Pluses. And there's also a possibility that Apple will finally get a sapphire glass option on the iPhone. It looks like it's going to be reserved for just specific models of the iPhone 6 Plus. That is, if Apple can resolve some of the drop issues. Apparently, that's what's been holding up Sapphire Glass in testing. A few other little things. It will have gesture control support and then also new improved Touch ID sensors that are supposed to help make Apple Pay a little bit more reliable. So there you have it. What is currently rumored for the next generation iPhone 6S and iPhone 6S Plus. As far as how many Apple might sell, Kuo predicts that Apple will ship between 80 to 90 million units in 2015. Are you ready for HomeKit? I am so ready for it. Actually, I was ready for it when they announced it, about a year ago? So you can imagine that I wasn't too happy, and maybe you weren't either, to hear Fortune reporting that Apple has pushed back the launch date of HomeKit from a May-June timeframe of this year to late August or September. They claimed that Apple has been having issues making it easy to sign in and get your devices, things like door locks, light bulbs, etc., online. And that's been much harder, apparently, than Apple anticipated, and that caused the delay. Supposedly, their code base became so bloated that it was requiring way too much memory for the smaller battery-powered versions of HomeKit devices, and that caused them to rethink and say, nope, we're not going to get products out until August or September. Luckily, though, Apple quickly came out to respond to the Fortune report saying that, quote, HomeKit has been available, and they're talking about the hardware certification. HomeKit hardware certification has been available for just a few months, and we already have dozens of partners who have committed to bringing HomeKit accessories to market, and we are looking forward to the first ones coming next month. So that would mean Apple is saying, basically, we should see some HomeKit products in June. Happy to hear that. I, in some ways, think that announcing HomeKit almost a year ago and leaving us to not see a single HomeKit device hit the market until next month is maybe announcing the thing a little bit prematurely. I think some of the buzz that they got from the announcement has sort of wore off. I know it has for me. I'm not all that excited, or at least not as excited as I was. I'm more in a mood now of I'll believe it when I see it. I got a little more excited, as you remember, back in January during CES when they were announcing, hey, we're going to have HomeKit products, and they will be out in the late spring, June, May, June timeframe. And now that we haven't seen those products sort of coming out, I'm just really curious when we're actually going to get something. But Apple says June, so fingers crossed, maybe something is coming. Something that could help things along is Broadcom, or I guess somebody who could help things along would be Broadcom. They make chips that will support and technologies that will support HomeKit, and this week they announced that they have a new Internet of Things SDK that will be the first to officially support the HomeKit specification for Wi-Fi and Bluetooth smart accessories. It's going to allow developers to use Broadcom's wireless internet connectivity for embedded devices. WICED, I'm going to call it, WICED, their WICED platform to actually build apps that will support HomeKit devices. Another cool thing about that platform is that in addition, devices that integrate the WICED module can be bridged to non-HomeKit devices to allow them to be controlled by apps using the WICED SDK. So in essence, what that means is that if I have a WICED plug and then I also have a non-HomeKit light bulb, that WICED plug module can actually serve as a bridge to allow me to communicate to the non-HomeKit light bulb and be able to control that from an app that uses the WICED SDK. So that will open up more products, even if they don't officially support HomeKit, to the HomeKit platform. So that's actually pretty cool, and I got a little bit excited about that when I was reading that announcement. They also announced that they have a new version of their Bluetooth smart chip that will enable twice the data rates over Bluetooth SmartLink and that are future-proofed for the Bluetooth 5.0 specification. So Broadcom has the protocol chips and things like that a lot of your smart home Internet of Things accessories are going to be using, and the fact that they are supporting the HomeKit specification with this new SDK I think is good news for the platform. So maybe we're getting back on track, but once again, I'll believe it when I can actually walk into a retail store and buy some HomeKit-supported products. And then finally, in the news for this week, it looks like Apple Pay is expanding to another pretty major retailer here in the U.S. I think last episode we talked about Best Buy finally coming on board and saying that they're going to support Apple Pay, and also the huge expansion of Apple Pay at Home Depot. They're going to have Apple Pay made available in about 2,000 of their stores in the U.S. They are currently switching over their equipment. So they had been supporting it. Apparently, they're not at the moment, but once they get the new equipment in place, they will support it. I think they will be the actual biggest supporter of Apple Pay in the U.S. And now this week, we're hearing Trader Joe's, which is a popular sort of niche grocery store chain here in the U.S., they may soon be accepting Apple Pay as well. What's happened is customers have been noticing that the company has been upgrading their payment terminals in many of their stores, and some of those new terminals are actually the ones from VeriSign that have the little Apple Pay logo right there on the unit. Now, it's not clear if they're actually taking Apple Pay yet, but Apple Insider did get an official, did reach out for an official statement. They did not get one, but they supposedly talked to two managers at California stores who said the company was experimenting with various touchless payment solutions, including Apple's, but had not made any final decision on formal support yet. So there's been no official announcement. Looking like they have the supported terminals. Hopefully they will be actually supporting it. If you've happened to have gone into a Trader Joe's and been able to use Apple Pay, let us know. We talked about this a little bit on the iOS show. I think Michael Johnston may have mentioned that he tried it out, but it wasn't quite working, at least in his store yet. So maybe we can be the first to report some Trader Joe's that are actually accepting Apple Pay. I love Apple Pay. I try and use it as much as I possibly can. But I think as we talked about on a prior episode of the MacCast, actually finding out and figuring out which retailers are actually really supporting Apple Pay is a bit difficult. Apple has their website where they've announced partners, but not all of them have implemented the technology or have the new terminals. And even a lot of the places that support Apple Pay, they don't have any kind of signage or any logos or anything on the terminals to really let you know that you can use it. And I think this is a real problem for Apple. If customers are ambiguous or don't know if they could use Apple Pay or not, they're just going to reach back to their wallets and pull out their cards. And I don't think that's going to go a long way to sort of getting the ubiquitous usage of Apple Pay that Apple really wants. So it's good news when we hear that, you know, more retailers are getting on board with Apple Pay, but I think Apple needs to also step up a little bit and work with their retail partners to do a little bit more marketing for the technology. And I'd love to see them start doing that, but who knows? So I have a little correction from the last episode of the MacCast. I guess I shouldn't say little because this is a pretty big one. Okay, I messed up big on this one. I'll just admit it. Come out and admit it right up front. I think on the last show, or I know on the last show, I said that I thought that Time Machine would only back up your internal boot drive and not externals. And several of you wrote to point out, and rightly so, that I was absolutely wrong. Where this came from, though, just in my own defense, is that I tried searching to find out if you could use Time Machine with external drives, and I could find no definitive answer anywhere to actually say that it did, nor could I even find instructions on actually how to make it work with external drives, even if it could. And even Apple's website, Apple's own support documents, don't mention Time Machine supporting external drives. So I erred on the side of caution and just said, look, it works with your internal boot drive, and that's it. Well, that's not exactly correct. It looks like what happens is when you first connect an external USB drive and say, yes, I want to use this with Time Machine, it will set it up so that it is only backing up your root boot drive, basically excluding any other external drives that you have connected. But according to many of you, you say, I've been told that if you just simply go remove those exclusions, then it will happily start to back up external drives. Now, I think it makes sense to not back up external drives with Time Machine because if you think about it, for example, I have 3 1-gigabyte external drives connected to my MacBook Pro. If I let Time Machine back all of those up and my internal 500-gigabyte drive to my 2-terabyte Time Machine drive, I'm not going to have very much Time Machine history left over. My general rule of thumb is that you want double the storage on your Time Machine volume as what you're trying to back up. So if you're trying to back up a 500-gigabyte drive, you should have at least a 1-terabyte Time Machine drive, probably a 2-terabyte Time Machine drive. So I guess if you're going to use something like a Synology RAID system or a Drobo, then maybe it'll make sense to back up your external drives. But if you're just using your standard run-of-the-mill USB external hard drive, I think, what, about 4 terabytes is the biggest one you get? You're going to need a pretty big one if you're planning on backing up your externals along with your internal. But if you want to do it, you actually can do it. All you have to do is go into the System Preferences, into Time Machine, and then click on the Options and remove any external volumes from the exclusion list, the external volumes that you want to back up. And if you want to sort of pare things down a little bit more and not eat up all of your Time Machine storage, what you may want to do after adding back in some of your external volumes is you may want to add some specific folders within there that you're not going to back up. Another thing I'd really advise is don't have Time Machine back up your other drives that are doing backups, specifically things like your clone backups. So like I have one external drive that is for my super duper clone. I want to make sure that that is in my exclusions list for Time Machine because that's already a copy. That's only a copy of my internal drive, which is already being backed up by Time Machine. So there's no reason to back up the extra backup. I'm getting lost and confused in that, but hopefully it makes sense to you. Don't back up your backups to Time Machine. I need to make sure I say that right because, yes, you want to have multiple backups, but, yeah, you don't need a Time Machine backup of your Time Machine backup, what essentially amounts to your Time Machine backup. All clear? Great. Moving on. As I told you at the top of the show, I have been having a heck of a week with technology. Networking issues, software issues, OS issues, and I just wanted to talk about that a little bit and share some of my troubleshooting with you because I think it's helpful. And I had to go through all of this this week, so it's right at the sort of top of my mind. And so what's been happening is I was having this issue where I'd be on a Skype call, I'd be trying to do a podcast or specifically a video podcast, and the person on the other end saying, "Adam, your connection stinks." And I'm looking at Skype and I'm looking at, different data logs and things like that. And I cannot figure out at all why I'm having a problem. I'm hardwired in. I've connected to Ethernet directly, all sorts of things. And I just can't figure it out. So a couple of useful tools that can help you if you run into this sort of problem can be found in your Applications Utilities folder. Great place to look for some tools. And in there specifically, two apps that I use a lot when I'm doing troubleshooting are the console, which is all of your log files, and then also the activity monitor. And so when you fire up the console, a lot of people get overwhelmed by this. And I think I've talked about this in the past. When you fire up the console, you're going to see logs for absolutely everything. I think it defaults to the all messages log. And you're going to think that your Mac is completely broken because there are all kinds of errors in there. There's all kinds of things going on. A lot of it you don't really have to worry about. The point of this sort of firing this open and looking at it is just looking for specific anomalies. If you happen to know like a specific app that's giving you trouble, you might want to use the search functionality up at the top, which is really just a filter for all of the logs, and put in some keywords. So if it's Time Machine that you think you're having problems with, you might start typing in the word Time Machine, or maybe it's QuickTime, so you type QuickTime. And you can look through those error logs and see if there's anything that sort of stands out to you. It seems daunting and hard at first, but it can help you sort of pinpoint some problems. And I will just tell you, when you're working with the console, Google is your friend. So you can find an error message, and if you see something, you're like, I think that might be what my problem is, but you're not really sure, just do a little selection and then do, copy and paste that into Google and see what comes up. And, then very often you'll find a support thread. You'll see that other people are having similar issues, and you can often find some maybe additional troubleshooting, or maybe even just rule out, oh, nope, that's not it. That's a normal error message. Nothing wrong with that. Move along. And you don't get sort of hung up on that. I will also, though, warn you about what I call the WebMD syndrome. This is, you know, we all do this when we get sick, right? You'll start typing in your symptoms into Google or WebMD and then suddenly realize, oh my God, I'm going to die. That can happen with this troubleshooting of your Mac too. You might think that there's more wrong with your Mac than there really is. So take everything that you sort of find with a grain of salt. Really use it as a way of sort of narrowing down your search to try and more move you closer toward the answer of what's going on with your system. And so in my case, it didn't really turn up anything because I don't think I was having an operating system issue, but at least I was able to use the console to kind of rule that out. So after that, I went ahead and I used the activity monitor, which is also in your utilities folder. And most of the time, you know, when I'm using activity monitor, what I'm trying to look at is to see if I've got some sort of application running in the background using up all my resources, be it memory or processor. And so you can go in there, there's a memory tab, there's a processor tab, and you can kind of get a look and see, hey, is something using up all the CPU? What's going on there? And then you can kind of track down that application, see if it's gone awry. This time around, because I was having networking issues, what I wanted to actually look at, and something I hadn't really looked at before in the activity monitor, is the networking tab. And within the networking tab, you can see sort of the packets going in and out and which different applications are sending and receiving the most packets. What I really wanted to get at was, hey, am I getting any packet loss? This tool isn't really going to show you that. But at the very least, you can kind of see, oh, hey, this thing's, you know, sending out a lot of data. Is that maybe something that I want to turn off temporarily? And that's really what I was doing, was I was looking at things like, okay, crash plan is actually sending a lot of packets and data, obviously, because it's uploading and it's doing my backup, the transporter, some of the other tools that I use. And I just wanted to shut those down and sort of rule those out as potential issues that were causing some of my Skyping and video conferencing issues. So I played around in there a little bit. And because I was specifically having a Skype issue, another really handy tool inside Skype is their technical call window. If you go into the window menu when you're running a Skype call, you can get the technical call information. And that's going to show you a few things. Specifically, what you're going to want to look at is your send and receive packet loss number. And that should be as close to 0% as possible. You're also going to want to look at the what's called the jitter number. And again, you want a low jitter number, something under 100. And the further under 100 is probably pretty good. And then also take a look at relays. You know, basically how many servers is your Skype call bouncing through before it reaches its destination. And once again, a lower number is better. And one way you can potentially minimize the number of relays, specifically inside your network, is to go into your router, so your airport or whatever router you use, and set up port forwarding. So look at the preferences for Skype. Look at what port Skype is using on your Mac, and directly port forward any inbound traffic directly to that machine, so that it's not making any extra hops through your network. And that can maybe help fix up some of your Skype issues. So I played around with that, but believe it or not, the handiest tool, the one that ended up working out best for me, was good old Airport Utility. And what happened was, is I fired up Airport Utility, and I could see that my Airport Extreme was connected. I could see that my modem was connected and supposedly had an internet connection. But then in Airport Utility, guess what? Little amber light on my internet connection. You're not connected to the internet. And I would watch that thing go up and down. So it would turn amber, stay amber for a little bit, and then go green and be fine for a little while, be surfing around online, Safari, doing whatever. And then all of a sudden, my entire internet connection would slow down. And look over at Airport Utility. So what I did was fire up Airport Utility. I just left it open. And sure enough, the internet light would be amber again. So what it turned out was that my internet was dropping packets for whatever reason. Ended up having to call my service provider, which in my case is Cox. They took a look at the line. And as a matter of fact, as I was on the line with them, they could actually see the connection dropping packets. And so they ended up sending out a technician. The technician was able to verify there was no problem with any of my equipment or the line inside my house. And it turns out that somewhere along the line, they have an amplifier that is messing up, and it's causing the connection to sort of go up and down. So it's not completely off, but it is completely unreliable. And in some cases, it'll lock up so bad that I have to go back and completely reset my modem. But through using various tools that were built into my Mac, I was actually able to troubleshoot that. And when the technician came, I could kind of share all that information with them. And it helped speed the process along. So I thought I'd share that experience with you. And maybe that'll help you if you're having, you know, connectivity issues in the future with your Mac. Now, another thing that I ran across when I was kind of doing this was a totally different problem, but suddenly my email, specifically my Gmail account, lost its ability to send outbound email. And it was only one of my Gmail accounts. It was my Maccast Gmail account, probably the one that I use the most. If you've ever sent me an email, I've got to reply to you using that account, right? So that's the SMTP for that. Suddenly, I couldn't send out emails, and it was SMTP not authenticating. And I tracked it down and figured out it was something to do with my Google two-factor authentication. And if you've upgraded to OS X Yosemite and upgraded to version 10.10.3, Apple fixed two-factor authentication for Gmail accounts or Google accounts in the internet account. So if you go into System Preferences and you choose internet accounts and you add a new Google account and you're using two-factor authentication now, you can actually two-factor authenticate right into your account. In the past, what you had to do was set up application-specific passwords on Google and then use those instead of your standard Google login. Yosemite fixed that, and when I set up Google on my Yosemite machine, I used my standard two-factor password. Well, something happened, and somehow that got screwed up. And because it wasn't working, I decided, well, no big deal. I'll just remove my Google account, and I will add it back in. And that is when my trouble started, because for whatever reason, after I tried to re-add the account under internet accounts, it would look like everything was working and then suddenly to say an unknown error has occurred at the end of the process, so at the end of the sort of login process. So it would let me two-factor authenticate. It would let me pick which Google services I wanted to link into my Mac. In this case, it was just mail. And then it would completely error out and say an error has occurred, an unknown error has occurred. So, you know, real helpful error message. And while it would add my account, the account would be added as inactive. So I could not get in back into my Gmail at all. And I even went so far as to turn off and completely delete my iCloud keychain, because at one point I thought that might be the problem. And then I found a 4-page Apple discussion thread of other people having specifically this same issue. I will link to it in the show notes at maccast.com in case you've run into this. But what seems to have happened is it is a two-factor issue, and that once you've removed an account that had been previously added under the two-factor authentication, suddenly you can't get back in using two-factor. And there's some theories in that discussion thread. It's not 100% certain what the problem is, but one thing that happened recently is Google did turn off some deprecated APIs. That was back on April 20th, so it's possible that OS X Yosemite and Apple is maybe using some of those deprecated and removed APIs, and so that's why you can't sort of get back in and use the two-factor authentication. Long story short, what ended up being the fix for me was I just had to go back to using the old app-specific passwords and then set up, rather than using the Google preset in Yosemite to add the accounts, I had to use the add other account option and then pick add mail account. So you're going to have to go through and add each service sort of individually if you need to get back into things like contacts and stuff like that, and you need to use the app-specific passwords. And if you go into your Google account into the two-factor settings, that's where you can set up new app-specific passwords, and then you just use those with your account instead of your standard Google login. And apparently, according to that discussion thread, some people had contacted Apple Apple is reportedly aware of the issue and supposedly working on a fix. Hopefully it will come out in the upcoming OS X Yosemite 10.10.4 release, which I believe is rumored to be coming out sometime around WWDC. At the same time, Apple will release iOS 8.4. So a couple of little issues and some of the troubleshooting that I had to do that I wanted to share with you this week. Now that I have my Apple Watch, one of the accessories that I am really wanting to get for it is a nice Apple Watch stand. And right now I'm just using the charger that came with my Apple Watch Sport, the little white plastic thing. And I just kind of have it, you know, set on my nightstand. But, you know, it doesn't look really great. I mean, it works. It's functional. But, you know, I want a little more style to charging my Apple Watch at night. So I was very excited when I received this review from Oliver.
So here is a review of the Spigen Apple Watch stand that's $20 on Amazon. It's a really nice looking stand. It's made of aluminum, looks really good, works really well. I'm really happy with it. I'd really recommend it to anybody, especially for the value for money at $20. There are a few slight negatives, and they're relatively small, but I would just briefly highlight them. That's why I gave it 4 stars instead of 5. The first is the cable management. The induction charging molds into the top, and that works really well. But from that point onwards, it's left to kind of be freestanding as it goes to the wall. And that could have been a bit nicer if they'd molded it into the rest of the case. The second is that the actual thickness of the metal is not that big. It does feel a little flimsy, as not as high quality as something that was maybe a little bit thicker, used a little bit more metal. But it's okay. I think it's still reasonable. It doesn't feel as high quality a product because of that, but still looks nice, and I'd still recommend it. The third, I received the Link bracelet for my Apple Watch this week as the watch arrived. And one of the downsides is that if the bracelet is open and I put my watch to charge, then the bracelet actually dangles on the base of the stand because the height is not quite high enough. And so that's a slight negative. I think if you have one of the other straps, this won't affect you. So on the whole, I would say that this is a great stand, especially value for money. Highly recommend it. I would go and purchase one if you're looking to get a nice stand for your new Apple Watch. Thanks as always for the show. It's amazing, and look forward to the next episode. Thank you. Bye.
Hey, thanks, Oliver. And hey, you're on the next episode. What do you know? Thank you so much for that review. I have been wanting to actually know about this stand a little bit more, so it's good to have that kind of first-hand account. I was a little concerned with the price because it is so affordable that, you know, it might not be that great, but it sounds great. And I actually went on Amazon right after I got your email and ordered mine up. It's not here yet. So I'll give my impressions maybe on the next show, but it sounds really great. I'm with you on the cable management. I've noticed a few of these stands that don't include kind of a cable management system, and I've seen some higher end ones that do, but they're really pricey. So I don't know. I might have to figure out if I can maybe do a little bit of a hack or some sort of workaround to keep the cable nice and clean. Because the stand looks really, really great, and I like the fact that it's metal versus plastic. And I just want to say something about, I don't know if it's called Spigen or Spigen or Spigen, however you pronounce their name. I think I've always called it Spigen or Spigen, but they often are one of the first to market with cases for Apple products. And if you're concerned about sort of the edge of your Apple Watch, and some people actually are, they also have some little cases or bumpers out for the Apple Watch that are also affordable. I think they start at $14.99, and I think there's more of a rugged one called Rugged Armor that gives your Apple Watch kind of the G-Shock look, which is $24.99. I like the what they call the thin fit case, which really just adds a little bit to the sides and edges of the Apple Watch. And I've even thought about maybe picking that up to bulk up my 38 millimeter, make it look a little bit larger because I'd like a little bit more profile on my wrist. So I might look into getting one of those. Although those, while they look like they're metal, I believe are just little plastic things that sort of clip over. but they still look pretty nice. And the rugged armor actually might double as a stealth anti-theft protection. We were talking about the Apple Watch not having anti-theft, but basically it makes it look like just a Casio G-Shock, you know, your average run-of-the-mill watch, and not necessarily an Apple Watch. So that actually may be a good thing if you're trying to avoid sort of being noticed with an Apple Watch. The other advantage is if you are going to be a little bit hard on your Apple Watch or might potentially drop it, you might consider getting one of these little cases for a little added protection, especially around the display. Unfortunately, our friend Leander Kahaney over at Cult of Mac has a little tale of woe this week. If you want to pop over there and read his article, he ended up having his Apple Watch dropped. He didn't do it, but one of his photographers did, and cracked his display. Luckily, he had a second Apple Watch already, so he's not out of an Apple Watch, but he's having a heck of a time getting his display replaced because at this point, Apple really doesn't have extra watches or extra components to do that. And even though he has the AppleCare Plus, so his, you know, accidental replacement fee is only $69, or on top of the $49 he paid for AppleCare Plus, he just literally can't get it fixed at this point, or it's taking quite a bit of time. So maybe having a little bumper case on your Apple Watch wouldn't be such a bad thing. And just to note, if you don't have the AppleCare Plus, which costs $49, your out-of-warranty replacement costs for a sport watch model is $229, $329 for the stainless steel model, and $2,800 for the edition model. So even if you end up buying the AppleCare and having to pay an incident charge of $69, you're at $118 to get your Apple Watch repaired. So it may or may not be worth it. I am waffling on whether or not I will get AppleCare Plus for my Apple Watch. If you don't buy it along with the watch itself, though, I guess apparently you have to go into the Apple Store to kind of show them your watch to prove that it doesn't have any existing damage before you can actually activate AppleCare, or so I've been told. I haven't actually done it, but a few people told me that that was the experience they had. But either way, maybe a $15 bumper case on your Apple Watch is a good investment in protection, and Spigen has those available right now. So it's spigen.com. And Oliver, thank you for the watchstand review. In case there was any doubt, I am actually pretty happy with my Apple Watch. I'm actually more happy with it than I thought I was going to be. It's become a pretty valuable accessory for me, I guess. Is it something that I could live without? I'm thinking probably I could, but, you know, if you've noticed the reviews and people talking about it in the tech community, a lot of us are pretty giddy over it. We're pretty happy about it. A lot of us really like it. There's occasionally a more negatively spun review, but in general, nerds like the Apple Watch, and I don't think that's super surprising, but, you know, I also received some feedback from the other side of the fence. Jeff emailed me, and he said, you know, I want to kind of hear the other side of the story, the folks who really don't necessarily need it or want an Apple Watch. So I think the easiest way is for me just to read his email to you. And he said it was okay, so I'm going to go ahead and do that. The email goes, I am not sure whether you would want to risk putting a downer on an Apple product in your show. Having been only a listener for the last 5 years, when all the new apples on the tree are worthy of glowing reviews, I have not been able to hear if you would name a stinker as being such when it emerged. Maybe I'm being unfair in wondering if you would take a warty view of the Apple Watch. And I absolutely am very happy to take a warty view of the Apple Watch because I think, you know, any opinion is valuable. So back to what Jeff was saying. Should you ever do so, here are my views as an ordinary bloke who is fortunate enough to be able to afford Apple products without denying himself other things. 1. As a recently retired 64-year-old, I feel that the watch would have been handy in my former job, but I now have no need for covert communications coming to me around the meeting table. I can happily refer to my phone. 2. I have never Twittered or Facebooked a demographic which will be lapping up the Apple Watch. 3, I don't wear a watch unless at posh occasions, if I can pronounce that, sorry about that, Jeff, with a suit. Although I still have pretty good vision, I prefer to put on reading glasses if doing anything extensive on my iPhone. I wonder whether I will be able to read stuff on the watch without pulling my readers out. I haven't heard anything on this yet, but it would negate any convenience of the glance. I know I could go to see one in the flesh to find out, but I don't trust myself not to buy one as a toy in spite of all my misgivings. And as far as, you know, readability without readers, we really depend, I think, Jeff, on your eyesight. I just recently had to get progressive lenses, and I can see it just fine with my progressives. I do, if I'm going to get it really close, I have to actually pull my glasses off. So I don't know, you know, what your situation is. But, yeah, you probably would need your readers in some cases to actually be able to read the display. It's pretty tiny. 5. Some of the bugs or inconveniences that are being aired tell me that they would be too much of a drain on me. Yep, as they say, retirement can be the busiest part of your life. 6, as an aging person, I will be interested in the direction the Apple Watch could go in the health area, but it's not been developed enough yet. And 7, I'm slightly nervous of the Google Glass syndrome in that an Apple Watch may denote me as a nerd on the streets. Sorry. Well, I think we should take pride in our nerdiness. More on that here in a second. Back to Jeff. Don't get me wrong. Our house is armed with iPads, iPhones, Apple TVs, iPods, an AirPort Extreme, a MacBook Pro 15-inch Retina, and a big iMac recently converted to a 1 terabyte SSD because of you. Thanks. But the Apple Watch is a step too far in that it offers me nothing essential yet. I just hope that I'm not a one-man groundhog that casts too long a shadow. I won't blame you for not joining in, airing such thoughts if you have them, but such an article would make a pleasant change from the multiple podcast-based fawning over the thing. I love this email, Jeff. I think it's great, and I think you make some very good points. Now I'm going to refute a lot of things that you are bringing up, and probably get you to buy an Apple Watch. I don't know. We'll see. The first thing I'm going to say is, you know, I really see nothing wrong with saying I think the Apple Watch is not for me. It certainly isn't for everyone. And if you don't need one or don't want one, that's fine. You don't need to. And don't take the peer pressure from this community that you necessarily need to have one. Now, that being said, here's some peer pressure. I'm going to be bold and say that I think you have pangs of desire for an Apple Watch. It's undermining this email, I think, you know, pretty obviously. You mentioned you can't even go into an Apple store because you're pretty certain you're going to buy one. That's because they're awesome, right? They are absolutely awesome. They are for sure a nerdy geek thing. You know, I think you may be looking to talk yourself out of actually embracing your inner geek. Embrace your inner geek, Jeff. So that being said, you know, does every piece of technology have to revolutionize our lives to have value or to be worth buying? I would say, what about just having the intrinsic value of making us happy? The thing makes me happy. You know, we nerds like this stuff. For some people, it's expensive cars that they don't need, or an expensive bottle of wine, or maybe just even a fancy meal. There's people that pay money for food that I think is crazy. I just don't understand, but it brings them a lot of joy and pleasure, and they're happy to do that, and there's nothing wrong with that. To me, the Apple Watch and other smartwatches, for that matter, you know, they change things for people in various and very small but significant ways, and I think that is good enough. I think this sort of review that puts this pressure that, you know, it has to be the next iPhone or the next iPod, I don't know that I necessarily buy that. You know, it's an accessory for those things, so I don't think it has to live up to that sort of level of disruptiveness, if that makes any sense. So, yes, you don't Facebook or Twitter, but, you know, what about something as small as getting a digital touch from a loved one who lets you know that they're thinking about you, or, you know, maybe the ability to take a phone call or get a text message when you stepped away from your phone for a minute. Or what about in an emergency? I mean, you know, not to focus on the getting older thing, but I know myself, I'm getting older as well. You know, what happens if you take a fall or a spill and, you know, maybe that's your link out, that's your communication out to get help. I mean, that's a pretty big deal. I'm not saying that, you know, you need to have an Apple Watch for that, but it is one benefit that an Apple Watch might be able to bring you. And, you know, it's a lot of these sort of smaller moments that happen often daily where the Apple Watch can come in really handy. I've started to use it. You know, I drink tea and I get a cup of tea and I now use Siri because I don't often take my phone with me as I'm walking around the house. I'm able to use Siri to set a timer really quickly right there on my watch, and I can set my tea timer, and then I make sure that it doesn't steep too long and get bitter. So I enjoy it for that. So, you know, could you do a lot of this stuff with another device? Yeah, you could, but think about the sci-fi nerdiness of doing it on your wrist. I mean, we've got a Dick Tracy watch now. I've wanted that since I was a little kid, and now I have one, and it makes me smile, and to me, that makes it all worth it. And I think that's okay. I think it really is. But it's also okay the other way. If you don't want it, don't get it. Don't waste your money. You don't need it. But, you know, that's kind of my two cents, and very happy to share a dissenting opinion on the Apple Watch, although I think you're not that dissenting. But either way, thanks for the email, Jeff. You know what you should do when you're having a week where the technology gods are not with you? What you should do is you should go and turn on an entirely new cloud service from a company who has, you know, not the greatest history with cloud services, right? It's a perfect time to do that. Oh, well, that's what I did this week. I finally took the leap and I turned on iCloud Photo Library. One reason being that I wanted to be able to talk about it to you. I've had lots of you ask me questions about iCloud Photo Library, and I wasn't using it, which makes it really hard to actually answer those questions. You know, the other reason is I personally just wanted to really try it out and see how it went and go through the experience. And I did end up having to purchase more iCloud storage. That was actually one of the things that was sort of making me hold off. I realized, you know, I have a 100 gigabyte iPhoto library, which means I'm going to have to pay $3.99 a month for the privilege of trying out iCloud Photo Library. So I did purchase the 200 gigabytes of storage. I went ahead and I made sure I had full backups, full multiple backups of my photo library before I began this process. And I double checked those backups to make sure that they were good and I could get to my photos on them, because I was predicting, especially with the week that I was having, that, you know, things might go wrong. And so I have set up my MacBook Pro as my source library. That's where all of my photos, iPhotos, are stored. And so that's going to be the one that I'm going to use as the main library. It's where all of my backups happen. So I went in there and I turned on iCloud Photo Library after, you know, upping my storage, and then set that, you know, the option to download originals to this Mac on that device. And that was some advice that was given by the folks at iMore. They've done a bunch of extensive articles on the Photos app, and you should check those out. Also, I'll mention our friend David Sparks has a new field guide out. You can go to maxsparky.com and get the details all on photos. So he's got a bunch of videos, hours of video tutorials and information, everything you need to know about photos. And so you should check that out and purchase that if you want some help sort of setting this stuff up. But I went through this and turned it on, and so far had nothing but issues. Now, it could be that I'm having network connectivity issues, because guess what? You've got to upload all of your photos to the iCloud Photo Service, and that's where I'm having most of my problems, is I keep seeing delays and stalls, and it's taking a really, really long time for me to get my photos up to iCloud Photo Library. I have about, I think about 13,000, 14,000 photos to get up there. and it really is taking forever. And then just to mention, on my iPhone and my iPad, I'm going to set those up, and I'm going to use the optimize on this device option, because I don't want all of my 14,000 photos being downloaded and stored on those devices. Obviously, I'm not going to have enough storage for that. So that's sort of how I'm setting things up, and we've talked about this a little bit in the past. But one of the reasons I also that I took the leap on the iCloud Photo Library is I received an email from MacCast listener Rob, and he did it, and he gave some great little bits of advice in setting this up. So, of course, he reiterated the backup thing, make sure that you have backups. He also mentioned that he cleared any synced photos and events from his iOS devices first. I didn't do that, and I'm kind of wishing that I had, and I actually have since gone back and done that, because I was syncing through iTunes, and I had a bunch of photos and things already on there. I went back and turned that off, and actually also had to literally go into image capture and actually delete a bunch of photos directly off of my iPhone. Because I have everything, again, I have everything backed up, and I have everything in the photos on my Mac, and I'm going to ultimately have that in my iCloud Photo Library, I wasn't worried about deleting my photos from my phone, because all of that's going to sync back down to the device. So it was kind of a good idea to actually have those devices clean of any photos, any extra data, so that you make sure that everything is coming from a single source and it's not having to do any weird merge stuff. Now, you shouldn't have to do that, and so do that if you want. Don't do it. I'm just telling you, when I didn't do it, I was having this weird issue where when I was connecting into photos and going into the import screen, it was trying to re-import a lot of the photos that it had downloaded from iCloud Photo Library. So I don't know what that's all about. I haven't had time to sort of troubleshoot that yet, but I just decided to head that off and say, look, I'm just going to wipe out my iPhone photos and sort of start over. I'll let them come back down. So hopefully that resolves that issue, but I haven't gotten there yet because I'm still waiting for all of my photos to actually get up into the cloud. The other thing that Rob recommended was moving your iPhoto events albums up to a higher level. So we talked about the fact that the Photos app does not have events like iPhoto does, and they're just turned into standard albums. Although when you do the import process, it creates a special set of albums called the iPhoto event albums. Luckily, it's really easy to turn those back into just sort of regular albums, or really just move them one level up into the albums area. You can just select them all, and then if you command click or right click on them, you'll see there's an option that says move them out of events, and you just select that and it will bump them up one level and just make them standard albums within your photo library. So Rob did that. I didn't do that either. I kind of like having my old events albums in that area. And then once you've done that, it's literally go into the iCloud Photo Library on the Mac and turn it on and then wait, because depending upon the size of your library, it can take a really long time. It's going to upload the full resolution originals, so it can take several days, if not weeks, I've heard, in some cases, depending upon the size of the library. And there is a background process, actually a few background processes that kick off that actually handle all of this stuff. There's a couple converters, I think one for photos and one for videos. And if you have a lot of videos, it takes even longer because it will upload those. And I did note in a couple blogs that they say those background processes kind of have unfettered access to your bandwidth, so they will eat up a lot of bandwidth cycles. So just be aware of that, especially if you're on a limited plan in terms of bandwidth. And if you need to pause it because you're doing some other work and you notice things slowing down specifically on your network, you can go into the Photo app, into Preferences under the iCloud tab, and there is a button that says pause for 1 day. You can click on that, and it will pause for 24 hours. If you want to come back and resume it, you can actually also manually resume it. So that's going on. But mine sort of started uploading and then stalled. But I really think, again, I think I'm an anomaly because I think it's related to my connectivity problems that I've been having. Although Rob did follow up and say that he saw some metadata issues that were a little bit concerning with images being copied back down to his iOS devices and Mac with the wrong image and location data. Not something that you want to see. So he'll see a photo And it's basically got the, you know, it's in a certain place. So say his 2010 album, but it's showing a photo that is actually from 2015. And what looks like the trouble might be is that photos with the same file name, regardless of what sort of folder structure they were in within Photos, appear to be getting misconnected or even sort of overwritten on the iCloud side. And it appears that what's happening is when everything's uploaded to iCloud, it's being done through some sort of export function. Rob has been working with Apple support to kind of troubleshoot this. And what he says they say is there's some sort of export function that's happening, and it's possibly ignoring the folder structure, which is causing this problem. And if you've used a digital camera, you know they sort of give default file names. So it might be like img_0123.jpg. And if you have two of those with the same name, which is likely to happen, even if they're in different folders, apparently it can cause this metadata problem. So, you know, on hearing that and just based on my own experience, if you are at all leery about iCloud Photo Library, you may want to hold off and let sort of the rest of us be your guinea pig testers. But I jumped in because it was getting some pretty glowing reviews, and a lot of people have had a really good experience with it. So far, my experience has been dodgy, but I'm willing to chalk that up to some of my own issues. I'll have to report back and let you know how it goes once, you know, my network connection gets filtered out. Hopefully, I haven't messed up my my photo library, and hopefully I don't run into some of the issues that Rob has run into, but I will keep you posted and updated. And if you want to share your own iCloud photo library stories, good or bad, please do that. Shoot us an email or an audio comment, mattcast@gmail.com. So the other thing I want to talk about with respect to photos is probably the biggest concern I'm hearing about from a number of people as they're transitioning from iPhoto to Photos. And that is this thing that actually Lauren sent me this voicemail about.
Hey, Adam. This is Lauren from Innsbruck in Austria. I was just wondering, since the new Photos application has come into OS X with OS X upgrade 10.10.3, and it's supposedly being the replacement for iPhoto and also Aperture if you bought that a couple of years back, I was wondering, how do you deal with the fact that the organization of photos by events is now gone? I'm really used to using iPhoto, and I always try to categorize my photos by events and also group them together by events. And of course, all my prior to the switch created events have gotten imported into this Photos application as iPhoto events, but I'm not able to create new events anymore when I import photos from my iPhone, my iPad, my digital cameras, what have you. And so I was wondering just what's your thoughts on this, and how do you deal with the lack of the ability of organizing your photos by events? Love the MacCast. Thank you. Bye.
Hey, Lauren. Thanks for the voicemail. I loved events also in iPhoto. It was actually one of my favorite features, the fact that as you imported, it sort of automatically created these sections, these categories of your events. And I think my reaction is that I think in a lot of ways, this change is really a semantic one. It's just in the language, because Apple now automatically organizes your photos into what they call collections and moments. And Moments, really, if you look at it, does exactly the same thing as Events, the only difference being that you can't assign a moment a custom name like you could an event. The other thing, I guess, is that you can't currently merge moments together. But really, the events in iPhoto, all that was happening was as you did an import, Apple would automatically divide your photos into groups based on the date the photo was taken and the location data. So if you took a bunch of photos in the same location on the same day, those were grouped together, and Apple called that an event, right? And as a matter of fact, in my own iPhoto library, I never renamed a lot of my events. So when they imported into Photos, basically all I have is a bunch of photos grouped together by specific dates, which is really exactly what it looks like when I import and look at my photos in Moments. So luckily, I think that the fix for this is really pretty easy because Moments can easily be converted into albums in the Photos application. So after you do your import, all you have to do is go into the Photos tab and then drill down and locate the Moments for that import that you just brought in. And then on the right side of the interface, just, you know, for that moment, just above the photos, if you put your cursor up over there, you'll see up will pop up a couple of different options. You have the options for a slideshow. There's an add button, a little plus icon, and then there's your share buttons for sharing your photos. If you click on the little plus button, you get a drop down menu, and one of the choices is to add an album. So you just say add album on that moment, and then you can give that album a name. By default, it gives it the location and the date, just like it did for an event. Then you can accept that or provide your own name. And then under the album dropdown, you could choose to put it under iPhoto events if you'd like, or just set it up as a standard album. And then click OK, and then boom, you have what amounts to basically your event album. And it just, so it might take a couple extra clicks, you know, than it did before. I think with events, the only click you had to make was sort of changing the title. Here, you're going to have to click the little plus symbol and then add a title, but you end up with what amounts to an event. It's just now an album in Photos rather than being this sort of special thing called an event. I hope that makes sense. And, you know, I think it's not that big a change, or at least it's not as big a change as many people think it is. I also had an email from Richard. This is somewhat related to photos, but really more related to taking video on the iPhone 6 and the 6 Plus. You can record video on the iPhone 6 and 6 Plus, 1080p up to 60 frames per second. And Richard does that, but he noticed that when he uploaded or exported video from his phone, it was coming out at 720p. And he was wondering, you know, did I miss a setting? How can I get the 1080p video off of my iPhone? And I played around with this a little bit too. And if you import your video off your phone into Photos and then drag it out of the Photos application and just drop it on the desktop, you do end up with a 720p video. And as far as looking on the iPhone, there doesn't appear to be any settings for actually saying I want to record in 1080p. So there is a setting for turning on the 60 frames a second option. By default, your iPhone 6 and 6 Plus, I think, is going to record in 30 frames per second, 1080p video. But Richard, in order to get the 720p video out, what he discovered was that if you just opened up the image capture application, rather than importing them into iPhoto or the Photos application, that if you imported directly to your Mac desktop from your phone through image capture, you would end up with the full 1080p video. Richard, I can also tell you that actually there are some options in the Photos application for getting the full resolution video out as well, because it actually is importing the 1080p 30 frame a second video. It's just when you do the drag and drop from the Photos application, it's doing some sort of conversion. I'm not really sure why it does that, but it apparently does. So if you want to get the full 1080p out of the Photos application, you have really kind of two options. One, you can click on the video and then go under the file menu under export, and you'll see an option that says export unmodified original. If you do that, you're going to get the full 1080p 30 frames per second, but you're also going to get none of the edits that you made. So if you went in the Photos application and you did some trimming or any kind of other editing, of course, you're not going to get that. If you want to export, get the 1080p, and retain any edits that you might have made, you do sort of the same thing. Select the video, go under the file menu, under export, and then choose export video. And then when you choose that, you'll notice there's a movie quality option. I think the default is set to 720p, but you can also choose 1080p. And if you do that, then you'll export the 1080p version. I also noticed that there's a 4K option in there. But if you choose that, it still just generates a 1080p video file. I think it's been discovered that the iPhone 6 Plus and maybe the 6 can actually shoot 4K video, but you actually need a special application to be able to do that. The default camera application, I don't think, will shoot at 4K. I could be wrong on that, but I don't think it does, which is why it probably doesn't export at 4K, even if you pick that option. But hopefully that sort of solves the mystery of how to get 1080p video off of your iPhone. All right, I think we just have the thing of the moment for this week, and then we will be finished up. This week, my thing of the moment is actually a website, actually a really, really cool website. So I needed to get some album art, or more specifically, some video art for some movies that I had ripped. And I like to get the highest quality album art I possibly can. And really, if you go into the iTunes store, Apple does such a great job with their album art. They use really high res, really high quality stuff, you know, because it's Apple. So I've always wanted a way to be able to get Apple's version of the album art, but get it for stuff that I've ripped or put into iTunes myself. And you can kind of sometimes find that online. I've messed around with, you know, doing the search on the web and then getting to the web version of the Apple Store page and trying to rip the art off of there. But this week I found an easier way. There is an awesome website. This guy named Ben Dodson actually has a site and an application called iTunes Artwork Finder. And it's just a simple search. You can search by music, podcasts, books, TV shows, movies, basically anything that's in the App Store. You can search on the title, and it will give you the Apple artwork for that, sometimes in full high res. You can get the highest res that Apple has available. And it is super, super easy. You can even get screenshots and videos for applications if the developer has those available for their app. So it's a great way to get this high-quality artwork. Under the hood, it actually uses Apple's public iTunes search API, which anybody can use. And actually, Ben links to it. I'll link to it in the show notes at maccast.com. But then you got to like build out these funky URLs, and you got to know the right fields to put in there. Don't do that. Ben's done all of the hard work for us, making it totally easy to skim and get Apple's high-quality versions of album art and iTunes artwork. So bendodson.com is the website, and I'll have a link to it in the show notes at maccast.com. But it's awesome, and I tweeted out about it, and a few of you already tweeted back, hey, I've been using that for years, and it's great. So don't just take my word for it. Others in the MacCast community think it's awesome, too. So check that out. But with that, that is going to do it for this episode of the MacCast for this week. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank all of my show sponsors. Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen, and Disk Label. Also, Text Expander Touch for your iOS devices, along with PDF Pen for iPhone and iPad, as well as PDF Pen Scan Plus. You can check out all their great software, get more information and details over at smilesoftware.com. Gazelle is the fast and simple way to sell your used gadgets. You can find out what your used iPhone, iPad, or other Apple products are worth by going to gazelle.com. And lynda.com. Lynda.com helps you learn and keep up to date with your software, pick up brand new skills, or explore new hobbies with their easy-to-follow video tutorials. You can get a free trial of lynda.com by going to lynda.com/maccast. Get that for 10 days. That's lynda.com/maccast. And a big thank you to all of my sponsors for their support of the show. Bandwidth for the MacCast is provided by CacheFly. You can find them at cachefly.com. And all advertising on the MacCast is handled by Backbeat Media. They're at backbeatmedia.com. I also want to remind you to go to maccast.com/radtech and sign up for our RadTech giveaway. RadTech makes awesome accessories and products for your Mac, and they were kind enough to send me a bunch of great products to give away. I've got Urban Armor gear cases for iPhone 6 and 6 Plus. I've got their screensavers, which I absolutely love. It was actually my pick of the week last week, or my thing of the moment, I should say, last week. They sent me some WaveJammer Bluetooth wireless audio receivers, just a bunch of really neat stuff. And if you'd like to be signed up to possibly get one of those products, you can just enter at maccast.com/radtech. Simple little form. Just fill that out. And I will announce winners sometime in early June. And don't worry if you don't win something, because right now RadTech has actually offered all MacCast listeners a little bonus. If you want to get one of their great products, you can get 20% off. Just use the code MacCast20 at checkout. That's MacCast20 at checkout over at radtech.us. And you'll get 20% off your order. And so thanks to them for the discount as well as the giveaway. With that, that is going to do it for this episode of the MacCast. If you have any feedback for me, a comment, a question, something you'd like to hear covered on an episode, you can shoot me email. MacCast@gmail.com is the email address. You're also welcome to call in and leave a voicemail on the listener hotline. That number is 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IAM-9. If you are outside the U.S. and want to save on long distance charges, you can also leave voicemail on Skype. And my Skype username is the MacCast. So just use that, call in, and there's a voicemail there as well. If you need show notes, links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you'll find those on the website. That's at maccast.com. And while you're there, be sure to check out the forum at forum.maccast.com. And I'm on all the social medias, the Twitters, the Facebooky things, also the Google Pluses. You can follow me on Twitter, twitter.com/MacCast, or you can check out the MacCast Facebook page over at facebook.com/TheMacCast. Or I just got a Google Plus URL. Finally, they offered me a URL. You can go to google.com/plus, the plus symbol, MacCast. So google.com/plus MacCast to access the MacCast Google Plus page. So that's it for now. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.